The person that's coming up now is a person who has, in a sense, changed the face of folk music to the large American public, because he has brought it to it a point of view of a poet. Ladies and gentlemen, the person that's going to come up now has a limited amount of time. His name is Bob Dylan.
No, that's right. That's not too fast at all. Yeah, that's good. Go ahead.
Genius in Motion. That is from the sessions of Highway 61 as Bob Dylan plays Al Cooper's. That's Al Cooper's Police Whistle. More on that later. This is Eric Nelson occupying the space formerly known as the Grateful Dead Zone, but a special 2 hours. And don't know quite how this is going to go. I'm going to make an alternate movie. We're going to make an alternate movie today. I'm going to assume that you have seen Complete Unknown. Complete Unknown. I got to get my Rolling Stone lines intact. Complete Unknown, the new feature bio, Timothy Chalamet's film. Everybody's talking about it. But if you haven't seen it and you don't mind spoilers, that's okay too. But I have some issues with that movie. I'm in a fanatic Dylanologist, and the issues aren't what you'd think. Yeah, the fact that Bob bought the police whistle and brought it into the Highway 61 sessions, I did notice that. Not true, but what the hey. And let's be clear. I think the movie, he's great, does a great Dylan. The Joan Baez, she's fantastic in her own singing, looks right. You know, Ed Norton, incredible as Pete Seeger. So many great things in this movie. My problem with it is, though, it could have been so much better a movie. Now, Werner Herzog, someone who I have some familiarity with personally and professionally, he talked about movies, two kinds of movies, certainly documentaries, but applies here. The accountant's truth versus the ecstatic truth. So the accountant's truth is, as Werner would say, like you could film the phone book. It's accurate, but it's not interesting. It's facts and real story that is stripped of insight. The ecstatic truth is insight that cancels reality. It didn't happen that way, but it feels truer than what really did happen. My beef with Complete Unknown is it has no facts nor real story and almost zero insight. And they had all the chances. They had a chance to get this right. They could have made the perfect bio jukebox musical. Bob gave them all the rights to all the songs, you know, endorsed the film. His manager is a producer of the film, and we can talk about why Dylan loves the movie so much later. But with all the chances to do it, they messed it up. And so what I'm going to do in the next 2 hours is talk about the movie, dissect the movie, and play real versions, Bob's actual versions of a lot of the songs that are in the movie, and talk about how the movie should have gone. So let's start at the beginning, shall we? So the movie starts, and again, spoiler mania, turn off your radio, it's okay. Save this later, come back. This will be posted on KSQD's website if you want to check it out and you don't want to have the movie spoiled. But I'm spoiling it. So Dylan arrives into town by himself, not true. He was in a car with some other people, gets out of the car, walks into a bar, runs into Dave Van Ronk very briefly, a huge figure in Dylan's life, but he's given one scene where Dylan says, "Hey, where's Woody?" He directs him out of town to visit Woody in East Orange. They don't mention it, but that's where Woody was. And when Dylan walks into the room, there's Pete Seeger. Didn't happen, but what the hey, you know? As John Ford said, print the legend. So Pete Seeger's there. So Bob sits down and he performs a song. The problem is it's the wrong song. They they should have played another song that's actually in the movie. They should have moved this song up early. Now, this is Bob himself. This is recorded in December of 1961 when Bob went back to Minneapolis and showed all of his old cronies just how good he'd become. And they have this song later on in the movie in the wrong place. And that's my one of my major beefs with this movie is the music is all in the wrong place. So imagine, Bob Dylan is in front of Woody. This is an original Dylan song, and Dylan has left home. He's been on the road. He's left Minneapolis to tempt fate. So tell me this wouldn't have been a better song to play in front of Woody Guthrie.
The train. Come in. Huh? Sorry, Bobby. Yeah. It must be good for somebody, this sir song. I know it's good for somebody. If it ain't for me, it's good for somebody. I just talked about it. I was young when I left home, but I've been out of rambling round, and I never wrote a letter to my home, to my home, Lord, to my home, and I never wrote a letter to my home. It was just the other day, I was drinking on my pay, when I met an old friend I used to know. Said your mother's dead and gone, baby sister's all gone wrong, and your daddy needs you home right away. I had a shirt on my back, not a penny on my name, but I can't go home this way, this way. Lord, 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 and I can't go home this way. If you miss the train I'm on, count the days I'm gone. You will hear that whistle blow 100 miles. 100 miles, honey, baby. Lord, Lord, Lord. And you hear that whistle blow 100 miles. I've played on a track, more will come and whip me back on them trestles down by old Jim McKay's. When I pay the debt I owe to the commissary store, I will pawn my watch and chain and go home. Go home. Lord, Lord, Lord. I will pawn the watch and chain and go home. Used to tell my ma sometimes, when I see them riding blinds, gonna make me a home out in the wind, in the wind, Lord, in the wind. make me a home out in the wind. I don't like it in the wind. I'll go back home again, but I can't go home. There's a way, there's a way. Lord, Lord, Lord. And I can't go home. There's a way. Home, and I've been on a rambling round, and I never wrote a letter to my home, to my home. Lord, Lord, Lord. And I never wrote a letter to my home.
Twenty-year-old Bob Dylan. So imagine the reaction shots of Woody and Pete watching that. The soulful singing. This guy sounds like he's 60 years old. He's lonely. And yes, I was young when I left home. Pete feels sorry for him, even though it didn't happen. Pete in the movie takes Bob home. They overnight. He has a sleepover at Pete's house. Toshi Seeger, who was an absolute force of nature, who has about three lines. There's a great article. Meryl Marco, former head writer of the David Letterman show, did an article really unpacking how neglected she is from the film's narrative. But that's on her watch, not on mine. But anyway, so there's a scene which is they discover the obligatory, this kid is a genius scene. Okay, so get it. They see him writing a song and playing a song. Now, the song, I'll give it away, is Girl from the North Country, a song that Dylan wouldn't write for another year, and a song that Dylan wrote after he had gone to England to star in a BBC play, because he was definitely coming up in the world. He met Martin Carthy, who taught him a song called Scarborough Fair. And yes, Dylan got to it first, unlike Paul Simon, who just lifted it, performed it, turned it into a huge hit, and yes, didn't pay Martin Carthy any residuals. Dylan rewrote it as Girl from the North Country. So the scene with Pete Seeger and Toshi looking awestruck at Dylan is he's, quote, writing Girl from the North Country. But the problem is Girl from the North Country, it sounds like Seeger would have known Scarborough Fair. First thing Seeger would have said is, hey, wait a minute. You know, Seeger had an encyclopedic memory of folk songs. But I digress. How about instead of that, Bob has just seen Woody Guthrie. He just had this encounter in the movie with Woody Guthrie. So what if Bob was writing this song that was inspired by the events that had just happened that day? Don't you think that would have given a lot of more attention to Dylan being a creative genius? That, wait a minute, you met Woody and you wrote this song that night? Well, anyway, this is that song. This was recorded a month before I was young when I left home. This is at Carnegie Chapter Hall. This was, I think, 40 people came to this gig. Very small, but this is Bob's really first official concert in New York, Uptown. So this is the song that should have been played. This is a song that we should have seen him writing right after he had met Woody Guthrie.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking the road other men have gone down. I'm seeing a new world of places and things. Dear paupers and peasants and princes and kings. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song. got a funny old world, it's rolling along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a dying, it's hardly been born. Hey, Woody, but I know that you know all the things I'm saying and many times more. I'm singing you this song, but I can't sing enough, 'cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done. Here's to Cisco and Sonny and Leadbelly too, and to all the good people that have traveled with you. Here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I could leave today. Somewhere down the road someday, the very last thing that I'd want to do is to say I've been hitting some hard traveling too.
Like more than 50 people there. So in the alternate version of Complete Unknown, Pete Seeger sees Bob write that song having just met Woody. And of course, it resonates tremendously. But no, that's not how it went. So let's move on now. We heard I Was Young When I Left Home. And that goes in the Joan Baez Discovers Bob Dylan Singing Scene. If you're just tuning in, this is Eric Nelson, and I'm doing the alternate remaster, bootleg version of the new Dylan movie, Complete Unknown, a movie which, it's all dressed up and no place to go narratively. And that, of course, is my entirely subjective personal opinion as a cranky Dylanologist. But my problem with the film is, as good as everyone is and as great as it looks, and the fact that Dylan's endorsed it, the music's all out of whack and out of place. It's wrong chronologically. The songs aren't played for maximum dramatic impact, and it really pays short shrift to Bob Dylan's genius. They just sort of say, well, look, he's a genius. Look, he's just, look how cool he is. They don't really show the process, and there's ways they could have shown the process. But I digress. So the scene where Joan discovers him in the nightclub, the great thing about Bob Dylan is that he just arrives in New York in January of 61 by the he's got a recording contract, I think, by September, and he records his first record in November. So just meteoric rise. He's already griping about being famous and about critics, and he hasn't even released his first album yet. And I talk about the song that I would have had in the nightclub, which also shows the quirky Woody side of Bob. You don't get a sense of Bob's sense of humor in this movie. More on that later. But Bob was always very, very funny. He got laughs in concert because he was funny. He was a mercurial, brilliant wit. And you don't really capture that. You just kind of capture, Chalamet just kind of captures, because of the script he was handed, kind of enigmatic Bob grunting a lot. But no, Bob was, when he wanted to be, could be funny as hell. But imagine if she walks in and she hears this, and it carries the Woody Guthrie scene going. This is Eric Nelson. This is KSQD. This is the alternate history of Complete Unknown. And this is the song, Dylan's griping at the age of 20. He hasn't had a first album yet, and he's already bitching about life in New York.
Rambling out of the Wild West, leaving the towns I love the best, thought I seen some ups and downs till I rambled into New York town. Middle of winter, down, down, New York town. Well, winter time in New York town, the wind blowing the snow around. Walked around, no place to go. I soon froze right to the bone. I just couldn't believe it, I was so cold. New York Times said it was the coldest winter in 17 years. I didn't feel so cold then. Well, I grabbed hold of a subway car, swung on to my old guitar. After a wheeling, railing, dealing ride, I got off on the downtown side, Greenwich Village. Folklore Center. Well, I walked down there and ended up on a coffee house on the block, and I'd get on the stage, sing and play. The man there said, "We can't use you today, come back some other time. You sound like a hillbilly anyway. We want folk singers here." Well, I finally got a harmonica job, begun to play, blowing my lungs out for a dollar a day. I blowed inside out and upside down. The man there said he liked my sound a whole lot. Dollar a day's worth. After weeks and weeks I hung around, I finally got a job in New York town. In a bigger place, money too, I even joined the union and paid my dues. Now, a very great man once said that some people rob you with a fountain pen. Don't take too long to find out just what he was talking about. A lot of people don't have much food on their table. They got a lot of forks, and they got a lot of knives, and they gotta find something to cut. So one morning when the sun was warm, I rambled out of New York town. I pulled my cap down over my eyes, headed up for the western skies. So long, New York. Howdy, East Orange.
East Orange is where he would head to the Greystone Hospital. I don't think the Greystone Hospital is actually in East Orange, but you got to love that song. So Bob's 20. His first album hasn't come out yet. He's been treated like royalty and gone from Hitchhiking Bob in January to New York Times celebrated guy doing concert in Carnegie Hall. And he's griping about critics and how badly he's been treated. So it's a recurring theme in Bob's work. And that song might have illuminated some of Bob's work. Plus, well, whatever. Wasn't in a complete unknown. If you're just tuning in, this is a dissection and restructuring of the movie Complete Unknown with the right music in the right place and some scenes that weren't in the movie. I want to point out that at this period of time, speaking of an easy scene to do, and I have no reasons not to believe Bob, his book chronicles his autobiography, which has a chapter, one of the chapters is on him arriving in New York. It's just too weird not to be true. He said he spent a lot of time in the New York Public Library reading microfilmed papers from the 1800s. He said the language and the stories really captivated him. So how about a scene without any words where Timothy Chalamet as Dylan is looking at microfilms, and in these articles we see certain words pop up that will of course appear in later Dylan songs. It happened, it's cool, and it shows Dylan booting up as Bob Dylan, which is what was happening during this period. He's booting up. He's becoming Bob Dylan. And that kind of process was just neglected, and they could have covered it. But anyway, I digress. So at some point, I think in the scene where Joan sees him, I was young when I left home, she runs into a cartoon version of Albert Grossman, who at that time was already Dylan's manager and way smarter than you give credit for. So at this time, Bob has written his greatest hit. And we know that what that song would be. And the scene that I would have had in the movie was One of Grossman's other clients, the successful client, was Peter, Paul, and Mary. And in fact, we heard the late Peter Yarrow's introduction to Newport, to the Electric Performance. It started off this whole shebang. But anyway, Grossman gives the song to Peter, Paul, and Mary for the hit. He gives it to them, and it becomes a mega hit. And Bob is quite happy with that happening, because Bob Dylan, besides being a genius, is also very conscious of money. Bob was always looking at the bottom line. And so how about that scene where Bob's song is handed off not to his rivals but to a commercial folk group, and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I think you know the song. We'll take a brief break from Bob. This is the song, and this would have been a nice song to have. Who would you have cast as Peter, Paul, and Mary in their 20s? I would have gotten T-Bone Burnett to find a great trio who could have stood in and done this song, but we'll have to settle for the originals. The original hit version that came out that basically really propelled Bob Dylan into superstardom.
Must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years must a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? How many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry?
You know, put that song out tomorrow, it would still be a top hit. You know, amazing that, again, what, 21-year-old Bob, 20-year-old Bob writes that song? Incredible. But a great version of Blowin' in the Wind, and the version, a version of which should have been in, but demonstrating Bob's preternatural instinct for commerciality despite everything else. So we have bringing on now Suze Rotello, who's known as Susie. Bob wanted her name changed. Heroic performance by Ellie Fanning, but very underwritten part. All she kind of does is look sad and give moony eyes to Bob, but you don't get a sense of the real Suze Rotello, who was extremely dynamic and taught Bob a lot about a lot and was someone to be reckoned with and was smart enough to dump him, basically, in 1963 and move on, and never regretted that decision. But if you're going to have that scene, let's have him do a different song that kind of illustrates Bob's sense of humor. They had him doing, I forget what they had in the movie, but it wasn't this. And if you do this song, this is what we filmmakers call foreshadowing. So I would have had Bob in the church scene, the Riverside church scene, perform this song, which, you know, if I heard someone this impish and funny and cool, I might, and I was a member of CORE and a lefty, I would say, who is this guy? He's funny and political and oh so handsome. So this is the song I would have had him do. This is from a concert at Brandeis University. And this song will play a little role in just a few minutes in Bob's career, in another scene that for some reason didn't make it into the movie.
This is called Talking John Birch, Paranoid Blues. I was feeling kind of low down and blue. I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists was coming around. They was in the air, they was on the ground, they was following me all over. I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, started walking off down the road. Yoo-hoo! I'm a real John Bircher now, look out. Now we all agree with Hitler's views, although he killed 6 million Jews, it don't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's a say, like if you got a cold, take a shot of malaria. I was looking everywhere for them gall darn reds. I got up in the morning, looked under my bed. Looked behind the kitchen and behind the door. Looked in the glove compartment of my car, couldn't find any. Look behind a sink, behind a chair. I was looking for them reds everywhere. I looked way up my chimney hole. Looked deep down inside my toilet bowl. I got away. I was sitting home alone and I started to sweat. I figured they was in my TV set. I peeked behind the picture frame, got a shock from my feet that hit me right up in the brain. Them reds did it. The hardcore ones. And I quit my job so I could work all alone, and I changed my name to Sherlock Holmes. Following some clues from my detective bag, I discovered there was red stripes and the American flag. Oh, Betsy Ross. Eisenhower, he's a Russian spy. Lincoln, Jefferson, and then a Roosevelt guy. To my knowledge, there's just one man that's really a true American. George Lincoln Rockwell. I know for a fact he hates commies because he picketed the movie Exodus. Well, I finally started thinking straight when I run out of things to investigate. I couldn't imagine anything else, and now I'm home investigating myself. Hope I don't find out anything. Good God.
for those keeping score at home, George Lincoln Rockwell, head of the American Nazi Party, and they picketed Otto Preminger's Exodus, and that was a big kerfluffle back there. But anyway, so Bob Dylan being Bob, and this is a scene that wasn't in the movie, but, you know, it's kind of a good scene. After Blowing in the Wind, he's invited on the Ed Sullivan Show, the biggest show in America by far. Remember what it did for the Beatles' career? Well, it could have done that for Bob Dylan. Bob goes on the show, and guess what song he wants to play? That song, Talkin' John Birch, Paranoid Blues. Now, does he honestly think that he was going to be able to get that on American primetime Sunday network television right after Topo Gigio and Bill Dana, the reluctant astronaut? But anyway, bit of history that people don't know. Ed Sullivan fought for it. Ed Sullivan wanted and supported Bob, but CBS would have none of it, and Bob basically said, either I play that or I don't play anything, and he walked off the show. So if you'd had that song earlier in the movie, you would have known when Bob walked in, what are you thinking, Bob? And this would have had a lot more impact. But anyway, they didn't have that scene and didn't make that particular connection. Another scene that's not in the movie as far as Bob walking off. And again, the idea that Bob was this sort of scuffling folk no one ever heard of. Harry Belafonte is, at that moment, huge. Movie star, musical star, top of the charts, absolutely enormous. And in February of 1962, right around the time all this is going on, we're doing another album called Midnight Special, and they need a harmonica player. And according, this is directly from an interview with Harry Belafonte, it was supposed to be Sonny Terry, but he got grounded by a thunderstorm in Memphis and couldn't make it. My guitarist, Miller Thomas, said, well, there's this kid I see all the time down in the village, and he does that whole Sonny Terry thing. He sleeps and he dreams it. So I said, okay, we don't have a choice. Find him. The skinny kid appears, has a paper sack with him full of harmonicas in different keys. I played the song for him. He pulled out one of the bag, dipped it in water, played through one take, and it was great. I loved it. And then I asked him, do you want to do another take? He said, no. And I asked him if he wanted to hear it back. He said, no. He just headed for the door and threw the harmonica in the trash can on his way out. I remember thinking, does he have that much disdain for what I'm doing? Now, that strikes me as a pretty dramatic scene. And again, it gives you an insight into Bob Dylan, Harry Belafonte. You know, it would have been a nice scene. Well, that was the lecture. This is the lab. So this is the one take that Bob Dylan played on the title track to a huge album by Harry Belafonte. And Dylan basically didn't like it, didn't want to be in that studio, and stalked out. But he did leave us with this.
Well, I wake up in the morning, hear the ding-dong ring. You go a-marching to the table, you see the same old thing. Baby, all I want to tell you, a knife, a fork, and a pan. And if you say a thing about it, you're in trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Yes, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, then you better walk or ride. You better not stagger, and you better not fight. 'Cause Sheriff Benson will arrest you, he'll carry you on down. And if the jury finds you guilty, you're penitentiary bound. So let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Midnight. yonder comes Miss Rosie. How I wonder, did you know? How well I know her by apron and the dress she wore. Umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She goes a-walking to the captain. I says, I'm losing my man. So let the midnight special shine his light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let that midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine its light on me. Mama, let that special shine its ever-loving light on me. Catch the midnight special shine its light on me. There's a midnight special shine its ever-loving.
K-Squid thanks the Santa Cruz Wharf for its support. After large swells caused the collapse of a portion of the wharf and temporary closure of all businesses, the wharf is once again open to visitors. The city is covering the first 2 hours of parking. More information is at cityofsantacruz.com. Thank you, Santa Cruz Wharf, for supporting K-Squid Community Radio.
And with that harmonica solo, Bob throws the harmonica contemptuously in the garbage and walks out. And a couple things about that. First off, we're still talking about 20-year-old Bob Dylan. The fact that he's invited to a session gig like that and basically walks out, okay. Second thing is how good he was. They wanted Sonny Terry. They couldn't get Sonny Terry. And Belafonte's very talented session guy says, I know a guy who's as good as Sonny Terry, and he's 20 years old. And that's one thing this movie really, really neglects, is what a brilliant musician Dylan is. Again, it's all Timothy Chalamet looking cool and grunting a lot, but they don't really get a sense of the process about how great a musician Dylan was. If you're just tuning in, this is Eric Nelson on KSQD, and I'm unpacking, restructuring, rearranging, something Bob Dylan was known to do. And there the comparison ends, but the movie A Complete Unknown, playing the music that should have been there and giving some new context, entirely out of alternate takes. You're probably not going to hear anything once you've ever heard before, but you may not have heard any of this before, except, of course, for Peter, Paul, and Mary's Blowing in the Wind. All right, so here's another big scene. The Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay, it's the Cuban Missile Crisis, October of 1962. And it's another Joan Baez. This is the first time they clench. You know, this is the she's so knocked out by Dylan's talent in this terrible time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when everybody is freaking out and trying to race out of New York, et cetera, because he's in a club and she sees him doing Masters of War. Okay, the song Masters of War. The problem is, there's a much better story here. There's another song that Bob actually wrote during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because Bob actually didn't think he was going to make it through the weekend. Everyone was pretty sure. There was justifiable paranoia. And if Richard Nixon had been in the White House and had won the 1960 election, or if JFK had listened to Lyndon Johnson, well, he wouldn't have probably gotten this song, and most of America would still be a radioactive cinder, but I digress. But the song that Bob did write, I think, would have been infinitely better song to win Joan Baez's heart. And it has the – not only is it the greatest apocalyptic song of all time, Dylan wrote it at the time. He put everything he had in it. I think he put every single song scrap he had laying around, because he was constantly writing, something he does to this day, constantly, on anything, matchbooks, hotel stationery, probably on wrist, just was possessed in writing. But this is the song that he was writing during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which would have been a much, much better, more profound choice than Masters of War. Let's face it, is something of a polemical song. It's great, it's anti-war, blah, blah, but it's no where near as great as this particular song.
Oh, where have you been, all blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw highway diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall. And what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sounds of a clown who cried in the alley. I heard the sound of one person who cried he was human. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall. And who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Yes, and who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met one woman whose body was burning. I met another girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. And it's a hard rain we're gonna fall. Oh, what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? 15 now, my darling young one. I'm going back out for the rain and start to falling. I'll walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and the hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, and the executioner's face is always well hidden, where the hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is the number. And I tell it and show it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart.
You started off slow, but boy, you ended up.
Yeah, that's a thing of mine there.
Tell me about the songs that you've sung, that you've written yourself, that you sing.
Oh, those are... Well, I don't claim to call them folk songs or anything. I just call them contemporary songs, I guess. You know, a lot of people paint. You know, if they got something that's they want to say, you know, they paint. Or a lot of people write. Well, I just write a song, you know, same thing, so... Want to hear one?
Why, yes, that's just what I had in mind, Bob Dylan. What if it made you think of that?
Let's see, what kind do you want to hear? I got a new one I wrote.
Yeah, you said you were going to play some of your new ones for me.
Yeah, I got a new one.
Sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. When the rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on. Don't think twice, it's all right. Turning on your light, babe, the light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe, I'm on the dark side of the road. Still I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, girl, like you never did before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, girl, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering all the way down the road. I once loved a woman, a child I'm a-told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. walking down that long, lonesome road, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. But goodbye's too good a word, gal, so I'll just say fare thee well. I ain't seen you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's all right.
This is Paul Hine, and I'm one of the hosts of the weekly music show, Runs on Grasoline. If you like bluegrass, folk, and Americana music, tune in to KSQD 90.7 FM, Saturdays at 2 p.m. Runs on Grasoline, here on K-Squid, community radio for the Monterey Bay Area.
Here's best-selling author Jonathan Franzen on why he likes K-Squid.
There is something really sweetly funky about K-Squid, I have to say. You walk in here and it feels, you're not in Pasadena, you are not in La Jolla, you're in Santa Cruz.
K-Squid Radio, many voices, one station.
KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale 89.7 FM, and Translator K20HGE Monterey 89.5 FM.
Gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Bob Dylan, what's the phrase? They do capture one thing in A Complete Unknown, and I hate to say this word on the radio, is Bob's occasional dickishness, and he definitely was dickish towards Suze Rotello. And that song was written when he was mooning all over her, but he couldn't admit it, so he wrote that song. A lot of passiveness and aggressionness going on in that particular song. So we heard a little excerpt. Cynthia Gooden did a radio show with Bob in March 11th, 1962, if you're keeping score at home. And that little, she just was utterly gobsmacked by him. It's a great interview where Bob's telling ridiculous lie after ridiculous lie, and she's eating it up with a proverbial spoon. And then we heard A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. I was at the Gaslight, recorded in 1962 by Richard Alderson, who on the 1966 Electric Tour, which the movie Complete Unknown doesn't get to, recorded all those apocalyptic shows, including The Judas Show. We'll be talking about that later. But for Dylan trivia, Richard Alderson, Dylan Hall of Fame. You're listening to a deep dive into the music of Bob Dylan, but most importantly, a deconstruction and rearrangement of Complete Unknown. If you're just tuning in, this is Eric Nelson. And, well, I had issues with the movie, not what you'd think. I didn't mind the fact that things were jumbled up and they were inventing scenes and compressing scenes. No issues with Timothy Chalamet. I think that's how Adam Sandler pronounces it. Monica, Joan Baez. She was amazing and sang her songs live and sounded astonishingly close to Joan Baez. So, and Ed Norton is fantastic as Pete Seeger. The problem was a really, and I hate to give my opinion on the radio, really crummy script. Whether or not Bob Dylan endorsed it, and he did, and I'll get to why I think he endorsed it later, a lot of liberties were taken that didn't help things. So let's talk about that for a sec. Let's talk about a liberty that didn't help things. We talked about Girl from the North Country earlier, a song that Martin Carthy taught Bob when he went to England to do the play Madhouse on Castle Street, where Bob was the itinerant folky. And, of course, the BBC wiped all copies of it. But literally, Bob was so amazing that he was being flown overseas to his first ever England trip to perform in a BBC play. And a very interesting trip, but that's where he picked up a lot of stuff. Carthy taught him Lord Franklin, which became Bob Dylan's dream. And yes, he picked up Girl from the North Country. So let's talk about Complete Unknown. There's a scene where they're getting Suze and Bob are an item now, and they're living in their apartment. And they have a scene where a package arrives for Robert Zimmerman, care of Bob Dylan. It's a very clumsy way of saying, hey, this guy used to be Robert Zimmerman. So they have a scene where Suze is leafing through the scrapbooks at a party. So it's a a little gathering at their house. And she's going through the scrapbooks, and somebody talks to her about the scrapbook. In the scrapbook is all of Bob's high school memorabilia. And I believe, I'd have to watch it again and do the old freeze frame, there's a picture of Bob with a high school girlfriend. And in reality, that would be Echo Hellstrom. That was his blonde, beautiful high school girlfriend, and they were quite an item there, quite an item. And there's a picture, or there could have been a picture, of Echo Hellstrom. So instead of no music at all, if you're going to, rather than have Bob do Girl from the North Country back when he first meets Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, which is wildly out of place and had no purpose to be, how about Bob is playing the song Girl from the North Country, which is about, drumroll please, Echo Hellstrom, as Suze is leafing through the scrapbook and we see a photograph and you see Suze Rotello, or Susie as she's called in the movie, have the epiphany that Bob is not only making up his name from Zimmerman to Dylan, but he's writing songs at the time they should be together about the great love of his life, Echo Hellstrom, which is, wait for it, Girl from the North Country. Better scene. Accurate. All you have to do is shuffle a song that you have the rights to a later scene. So I can't talk about Girl from the North Country without playing it, but imagine that scene, and Bob is playing it at the party for rabid people. You know, the people are becoming pseudo-groupies. So she's leafing through the scrapbooks. Bob, a.k.a. Timothy Chalamet, is performing this song, and Suze has the epiphany, oh my God, I've been psychically two-timed.
The red is gone. Well, if you're traveling in the North Country fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Well, if you go in the snowflake storm, when the river's freezing summer ends, she has a coat so warm. Keep her from the howling winds. Please see for me if her hair hangs long, if it rolls and flows all down her breast. Please see for me if her hair hangs long. That's the way I remember her best. I'm wondering if she remembers me at all. Many times I've often prayed in the darkness of my night, in the brightness of my day. So if you're traveling in the North Country fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She was once a true love of mine.
You psychic two-timer you, Bob. Here you're singing a song about Echo Hellstrom in my living room as I'm looking through your scrapbooks. You fraud. Anyway, would have been a better choice in that spot rather than when they had it. So let us move on. We're going to get into where things start to break down for Bob, or at least in the movie they break down. They have a scene where Bob is and Suze are watching the Kennedy assassination. It's the obligatory, what are they thinking? They're watching footage of the assassination. Bob's going through some changes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a song that Bob Dylan had at the time, just newly wrote and floating in the wind, would have been the perfect time for that song over that sequence, which would have really captured that moment in a bottle. If you're going to do a jukebox musical, for God's sakes, put the song where they'll have the most dramatic impact. It may be hokey, it may be Hollywood, but there's a time and a place for everything. And the place for this particular song would have been when they're watching the footage of the Kennedy assassination and ruminating on what's happened to America.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, 'cause the time, they are a-changing. Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in your doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. 'Cause the battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road's rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. 'Cause the times, they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slowest now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, 'cause the times, they are a-changing.
So, true story, Dylan, I think, had a concert the night of the Kennedy assassination and actually said, quote, Mr. Bob actually confessed he didn't know how he could open the show as he always did with that song, but he went ahead and did it anyway and got an applause. But Bob recognized the contradictions inherent in that song at the time of the Kennedy assassination, when that song was kind of his greatest hit. He would open shows with that a lot over the next few months. So this brings us to the couple scenes, one small and one big. So they have a scene where Suze and Bob are taking photographs that would become the iconic cover of Free Will and Bob Dylan. Of course, they don't actually show that scene and taking that picture, but they have a photographer. That might be a creative choice because they thought, oh, well, that's the obvious choice. But one part they could have said was, and this is Suze Rotella who tells the story, Bob was wearing chamois coat, whatever he's wearing. It was freezing that day, but Bob wanted to look cool, and she's all bundled up, but Bob was dressed very light, and he was freezing his ass off, his skinny ass off, when they were doing the picture. And it kind of shows how Bob looking cool was paramount. Another nice detail they could have had is Bob Dylan has really terrible vision. The reason he has his sunglasses, the iconic sunglasses, they're prescription. And when he was hanging out in the apartment with Suze, he would just wear normal glasses. And there's some great pictures, very candid pictures of the two of them goofing around in their apartment together that in two pictures says more about their relationship than the entirety of A Complete Unknown. I think the photographer's last name is Alper. So if you look, A-L-P-E-R. So look up Dylan Rotello and Alper, and you can find those images. But I digress. So anyway, this is the chronology. So the Kennedy assassination is late November of 1963. A few weeks later, and this is the biggest scene, this is the heart of the movie, the big scene that should have been in there. Bob is asked, is going to get an award, the Thomas Paine Award. And it's being given by, I think, the ACLU. And it's a banquet, and they're giving awards out to everybody. And somehow Bob gets roped into going. There's a great picture of Bob sitting next to James Baldwin. Nice scene to have. Bob sitting next to James Baldwin. What happens, though, is Bob gets drunker and drunker, drinking his fabled red wine. And by the time he gets up to do the award, he's pretty much snockered. And he starts a stream of consciousness rant, where he starts talking about his inner feelings. And midway through it, he makes a reference to he understands Lee Harvey Oswald and he shares in his alienation. You can imagine how well that went down. Everything that people say happened at Newport really happened in that ballroom. It was a disaster. And Bob had to write an apology letter. There was no joke. He had to diffuse the tension. But this is where Bob splits from the Pete Seeger left. This is the irrevocable break, and it's not in the movie. Now, in the other movie that takes its title from Like a Rolling Stone, that's Scorsese's No Direction Home, this is in there, and they feature it. So I'm going to play an excerpt from the speech, and as a shout-out to the great Martin Scorsese, Martin Scorsese reads it. This is Martin Scorsese reading an excerpt from that speech that pretty much signaled the irrevocable break between Dylan and the left. And in the middle of this, you're going to hear from the man himself. So it was clearly important enough for Scorsese to read it and Bob to comment on it, but for some inexplicable reason, wasn't in the movie, Complete Unknown.
I haven't got any guitar. I can talk, though. I want to thank you for the Tom Paine Award on behalf of everybody that went down to Cuba. First of all, because they're all young, and it took me a long time to get young. And now I consider myself young, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud that I'm young. And I only wish that all you people who are sitting out here tonight weren't here, and I could see all kinds of faces with hair in their head and everything like that, everything leading to youngness.
You know, they were trying to build me up as a topical songwriter. I was never a topical songwriter to begin with. For whatever reason they were doing it was reasons not really, that didn't really apply to me.
Old people, when their hair grows out, they should go out. I look down to see the people that are governing me and making my rules, and they haven't got any hair in their head. I get very uptight about it. There's no black and white, left and right to me anymore. There's only up and down, and down is very close to the ground. And I'm trying to go up without thinking about anything trivial such as politics.
Scorsese didn't read the part about Lee Harvey Oswald because No Direction Home, just like A Complete Unknown, was produced with the full and complete cooperation of Bob Dylan and his great manager, Jeff Rosen, great caretaker of the legend. But that speech was a breakthrough and a breakdown of Bob Dylan. So let's get back to Bob and Joan. So there's a scene where it's set in Carmel Valley, folks. That's where Joan was living. Bob came across to our own beloved Monterey Bay and wrote a lot of songs when he was there. Farewell Angelina was one. I bet he was tinkering with, well, we'll talk about that song later, a song called Lay Down Your Weary Tune, which I don't think we'll have time to go to, and a song that they should have had in the movie, And one of the reasons they should have had it in the movie was this is one song that Bob Dylan never did. There are no versions, no demos, no live performances, zip, nada. And in fact, in Don't Look Back, there's a great scene where Joan and Bob are in a hotel room. Bob's typing because he's always writing, and she's playing this song and finishes it. And Bob kind of looks over and asks Joan, did I ever finish it? And Joan shakes her head and said, Bob, you finished it about 8 different ways. So the scene I would have had in the movie would have been Bob writing this song, Chalamet singing the song for his Dylan freaks who would have gone, oh my God, finally, if Bob couldn't sing the song, at least we have faux Bob singing it. And it's also a song about love and romance, which speaks to the what they were doing in Carmel Valley. So no version of Bob doing the song, famous version of Joan doing the song, and a far less famous version is Joan doing the song at the Big Sur Festival. And yes, this does contain her patent-pended Bob Dylan imitation, which she does, well, in the ranks of Bob Dylan imitators, Bob Dylan's first. He does the best Bob Dylan imitation of all time, but Joan Baez is definitely hanging right in there.
Seems like only yesterday I left my mind behind. Down in the gypsy cafe with a friend of mine who sat with baby heavy on her knee. Spoke of life most free from slavery, with eyes that showed no trace of misery. The phrase in connection first with she occurred. That love is just a four-letter word. Outside a rattling storefront window, cats meow to the break of day. Me, I kept my mouth shut to you, I had no words to say. My experience was limited and underfed. You were rapping while I hid. To the one who was the father of your kid. Oh, well, you probably didn't think I did. I heard you say that love is just a four-letter word. I'll tell you, when I did it in France, they really didn't know what in the hell was going on. I went on my way unnoticed, to slip forth into my own game. In and out of lifetimes, unmentionable by name, searching for my double, looking for complete evaporation to the core. Though I tried and failed at finding any door, I must have thought that there was nothing more absurd. And that love is just a four-letter word. Strange it is to be beside you many years of tables turn. Probably not believe me if I told you all I've learned. And it is very, very weird indeed to hear words like forever. Fleets of ships run through my mind, I cannot cheat. It's like looking in a teacher's face complete. I can say nothing to you but repeat what I've heard, that love is just a four-letter word.
Great song, great lyrics, unperformed by Bob, and we could have seen Chalamet. I can't get Adam Sandler's pronunciation out of my brain there. So once, for once, I'm pronouncing something, if not right, semi-right. This is Eric Nelson. You're listening to a deep dish reconstruction, deconstruction, analysis, and bootleg version of the movie Complete Unknown, basically describing scenes that should have been in the movie, songs that were in the movie but were in the wrong place, generally an assault on The Dog's Breakfast, which I personally consider the script was. I think the movie itself, Chalamet and Monica, and I'm going to get her name, I swear, in the next break, so I pronounce it, give her the credit she deserves, Ellie Fanning, Ed Norton as Pete Seeger, the look of the thing, was all dressed up and no place to go. So let's talk about some scenes that weren't in the movie. So in February of 64, I believe it's February of 64, Bob goes on a road trip. He has some concerts to go to, and he gets in a station wagon. His company, Ashes and Sand, owns the station wagon. I think Paul Clayton, who some say Dylan copped the melody to Don't Think Twice off of, but that's a whole other story, and some other beatnik friends are with him, and they go on a road trip across the country, and they have adventures. One adventure, Dylan insists on stopping by Carl Sandburg's house. They know Carl Sandburg is, and Bob says, he's a poet, I'm a poet, hope I don't blow it. And he shows up on Carl Sandburg's doorstep, and Carl Sandburg graciously invites the beatniks in. Dylan gives them a copy of Times They Are Changing, and it's very clear to Bob that Carl Sandburg has absolutely no idea who Bob Dylan is. That's a pretty good scene for a movie. Another great scene happens in New Orleans where, drunk on Dylan's proverbial red wine, he goes out and busks. He goes out in the street to try to pick up some loose change, and a semi-riot ensues. So people instantly realize who he is, and one of those scenes they're trying to do in the movie where, ooh, he's a superstar, he can't go out. No wonder he's so paranoid. That actually happens, but in New Orleans on Bourbon Street where Bob's busking. Very dramatic. Now, they probably couldn't afford to do that. But while they're doing this road trip, Bob, he's always working, and they don't capture that in the movie, always. He's in the back of the station wagon with a typewriter, and he's writing songs. One of the songs we know he wrote on the road trip is Chimes of Freedom, and he's writing some other stuff. But while they're driving cross country, the AM radio's on. And Bob hears something on the AM radio, and in Bob's own words, it pretty much tore his head off. Everyone, all the beatniks are scoffing, but Bob says, oh my God, this is where music is going. This is the future of what I'm doing. I better get with the program. He has a religious experience. So how about a scene where Bob's tapping out Chimes of Freedom, and this song comes on the radio to sort of bring us up to a revelation in Bob's career.
Oh yeah, I tell you something, I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh please, say to me, let me be your man. To me, you let me hold your hand. I let me hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. And when I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. And when I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to
Bob said. The harmonies were just outrageous. Bob was listening so closely, he got the lyrics wrong. And he heard, I get high, which leads us to, well, a scene that any self-respecting jukebox musical would have to come in. And if it was in the movie, people would be saying, oh, come on. That is so ridiculous. That never happened. That's the worst cliched compression in all of movie history. And that, of course, is what happens in August of 1964 when Bob visits the Beatles on their second tour at the Delmonico's Hotel in New York City and brings in, he has his actual, his road buddy bring it in, brings in marijuana and says, hey guys, let's smoke pot. The Beatles say, wait for it, we've never smoked pot before. Bob says to the Beatles, but you wrote about it. You wrote, I get high. At which point John Lennon says, no, I sang, I can't hide. Bob has a little bit of egg in his face. He then goes on to turn the Beatles onto marijuana. They write a song together, allegedly. Imagine how much that would that was dumped in the Plaza's wastebasket. But you don't have to get Beatle lookalikes. There's a famous picture of Bob outside the hotel going in. So you have a scene outside where Bob is talking about his roadie smuggling in the pot, and then a jump cut to them coming out where Bob says, I can't believe they never smoked pot. You could also have a scene in the car when he hears, I want to hold your hand, where Bob says, oh my God, they're singing I Get High. It would have been a great little scene that, of course, is not in the movie. What do you do, right? This is Eric Nelson. This is KSQD, and I'm winding myself up here on lost opportunities in the movie Complete Unknown. Well, one of the songs that Bob was working on in the back of that limo, he worked on it a lot. He really spent a lot of time with this particular song. I'm going to play now, and I'm going to play the first time I think it was really publicly performed. It was May 17th, 1964. Bob did one concert. May was a good 64, 65, and 66. Bob was in London those Mays. In May of 64, he had one concert at the London at the Royal Festival Hall. In May of 65, he was all over England, played the Albert Hall, and that's featured in Don't Look Back. And then May of 66, that's Electric Bot with the frizzy hair, the Judas period, though he didn't do that at Albert Hall. But May of 64, May was a good Dylan in London month. So this is the first time Bob has ever played this song. And imagine this, you're in a concert hall with a rapt audience and you hear this song for the very first time. And you don't know what to expect. Are you going to get Bob singing Masters of War or God on Our Side? Yeah, you got that later in the show. But you also got this. And if you put yourself in the audience's positions, you talk about the sound of collective minds being blown.
Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet, I have no one to meet. And the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel to grip. My toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere. I am ready for to fade unto my own parade. Cast your dance and spell my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though you might hear laughing, spinning, swinging madly through the sun, it ain't aimed for anyone. It's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky, there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping reels of rhyme to your tambourine in time, it's just a ragged clown behind. I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just the shadow you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the hidden leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, up to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, driving memory and fate deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
You can hear the sound of a lot of collective minds being blown apart. First time ever that song was performed. So Bob is in England. He goes over to Greece and he starts writing new songs to Ramona, Spanish Harlem Incident, a little ditty called It Ain't Me, Babe, and My Back Pages. He'd already written Chimes of Freedom in the back of the limousine. He writes a very hateful song called Ballad in Plain D, which in exhaustive and boring detail documents the breakup with Suze Rotello and refers to Carla, her parasite sister. And even Bob said, and I quote, "I must have been a schmuck to write that song." And he was, in fact, a schmuck. Another song that's never been performed ever. So he comes back. He records another side of Bob Dylan in one night, June 9th of 1964. Nat Hentoff wrote a great article on Dylan, a profile of Dylan, and was there for that session. Guess what? Red wine. Bob gets plotzed. And by the time they get around to Mr. Tambourine Man, he's too drunk. He does a half-assed duet with Jack Elliott and doesn't put that song on the album. It would be a while before that song comes out. And instead, he puts on Ballad for Plain D. So, you know, Bob, choices, choices. Well, we're going to leave Joan Baez behind, but let's capture some of the magic. In October, Halloween 1964, Philharmonic Hall. In the movie, they're long since estranged and all sorts of stuff's going on. But let's capture the magic of the two together on stage. Joan Baez is just wonderful, always has been wonderful, a living legend. You can't say too much great about Joan Baez. Wicked sense of humor, and she can keep up with Bob throwing her musical curveball. So this is a duet between the two of them on yet another song that Bob left off another side of Bob Dylan.
Perhaps it's the color of the sun cut flat and covering the crossroads I'm standing at. Maybe it's the weather or something like that. But Mama, you've been on my mind. I don't mean trouble, please don't put me down, don't get upset, I am not pleading. Or say it, I can't forget you, I do not walk the floor, bow down and bend, but yet, Mama, you're just on my mind. Even though my mind is hazy and my thoughts, they might be narrow, where you've been, don't bother me, but bring me down with sorrow. It don't even matter where you're waking up tomorrow, but Mama, you're just on my mind. Myself pretending, not that I don't know that, Daddy, Mama, you've been on my mind.
It's not first verse.
When you know I won't be near, I'd just be curious to know if you can see yourself as clear as someone who has had you on his mind.
Those lovebirds, but you can tell the chemistry there and the humor, which again was sorely missing from this movie, is Dylan's humor. He had a great, great sense of humor. Well, we're in 1965 now. Yes, we finally arrived at the final act of this film. It's 1965. And boy, did they get this scene wrong. So there's a scene where Bob, it's now sunglasses, alienated, grunting Bob, and he goes to a swellagant penthouse apartment with a generic African-American woman with a British accent. No basis in any reality there. I don't fault Bob, you know, the choice there, but they could have done much better, I think, and been more true if they'd had Edie Sedgwick, one of Andy Warhol's stable of superstars, who Bob had a fling and a thing. One thing about Bob was, well, the man got around. And Edie Sedgwick should have been wearing to this party a leopard skin pillbox hat, which is something that Edie Sedgwick wore and Bob wrote the song on. It's what we call, folks, an Easter egg to Dylanologists. The people who recognized that would have thought it was the greatest thing ever. It was also true to history, and it was more accurate and kind of gets Bob's hanging out with Andy Warhol, which is a very interesting thing. True story. Bob had an original Warhol Elvis. Warhol gave him a painting, and Bob traded it for a couch. He traded the painting for a couch. So think about that. Bob, who was always conscious of his bank book, must have rued the day he did that. We don't even know what that thing's worth. By the way, Tambourine Man, original lyrics are up for auction, $250,000 starting bid. The estate of Al Arnowitz, he picked it up. Al was a journalist, the guy who introduced Dylan to the Beatles at the Delmonico Hotel. Al's the one who swung that meeting. But anyway, he picked up an early draft, and that's up for auction. But I digress. We're at the party. So they have Bob's in Alienated, and all the swells want him to do a song. He doesn't want to do it, and they cut to Bob doing a song, reluctantly. So they have him doing a song called When the Ship Comes In. Great song, one of my favorite obscure Dylan songs, a song that Dylan wrote in 63 when, wait for it, he and Joan Baez were on the road together and checked in together, and they wouldn't give them a room together because Bob looked scruffy. According to Joan Baez, she tells the story, Bob was so pissed off, he went upstairs to his separate room and wrote When the Ship Comes In for the desk clerk. So great story. But it's not the right song in that moment. It was old, dated. He never would have done it. The song that defines the whole movie is the song that Dylan should have done in that scene for the people there, the song that basically encapsulates his entire attitude towards the village, kind of summarizes everything you've seen in the movie and gets that cynical, jaundiced Bob as he heads into Newport. Would have been slightly out of chronology because he hadn't really written it yet, but, you know, they messed around with chronology. So this is the song they should have had Bob do acoustically, and the reaction shots as people listen to these lyrics among the swells and the people in the tuxedos would have been priceless.
Got a lot I knew to see you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning. You got a lot I knew to say you got a helping hand to lend. You just want to be on the side. That's winning. You say I've let you down. You know it's not like that. If you're so hurt, why then don't you show it? You say you've lost your faith, but that's not where it. You have no faith in yourself, and you know it. I know the reason that you talk behind my back. special and your place. Don't you understand? It's not my problem. I wish that just one time you could stand inside my shoes. And just for that moment, I could. You could stand inside my shoes. You know what a drag it is to see you.
Bob's singing to all the party goers, and he gets to the line, "You know what a drag it is to see you." Somebody like chokes on a cocktail weenie. But alas, that song wasn't in the movie, wasn't in that scene. So again, creative malpractice here. There's a scene where Bob is wandering around the apartment in his underwear, strumming Like a Rolling Stone before the session. And they cut, and they're doing the take of Like a Rolling Stone. And it is apocryphal, but true. Al Kooper was going to play guitar. Then he heard Mike Bloomfield tuning up, and he realized he had no chance. So he hid behind the organ and just sort of, luckily the organ was turned on, he started banging out chords, and when they got to the playback, Bob said, "Turn it up, keep it in," much to Tom Wilson, his producer's chagrin. All that happened. But what they don't document, the way they have it in the movie, it's like Bob had the song in his head and he went in and recorded it. Not true. And what they don't put together is Bob conjured this song up. Grill Marcus did an entire book on the session that created Like a Rolling Stone. At least one day, maybe two, Bob literally wrote and created this masterpiece in the studio around his musicians, which he did on Blonde on Blonde, when he was literally writing half the album while the musicians were playing poker and ping pong. So they could have had that in there. They could have shown the genius of Bob Dylan working with musicians and collaboratively creating a work of art. Totally Bob Dylan's art, but a process. How about jump cutting together the existing takes? All of them have been released. All of them are out. There's a mega box set called The Cutting Edge, which has every single take of Like a Rolling Stone up to take four, which is The Keeper. And then Bob kept going. They didn't realize they'd caught it, and they did like three more versions and then went back and realized, hey, wait a minute, love that organ on take four, Keeper, and the rest is history. So I'm just going to play one of the early takes to see how far the song evolved. And just imagine, though, if they just jump-cutted the various versions together of taken from, they have the record, they have the receipts, they have the audio record, you could really hear Bob in real time creating this masterpiece.
Once upon a time, first thing. Go ahead. I just played the introduction, man. Just those two things.
That was introduction. Is that too fast?
No, that's fine.
One, two, three, two, three, four.
You're dressed to find through the dumps of time in a time, then you people call, say be aware, dial, you're bound to fall, you thought they're all kidding you. You used to
make fun about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be out on your own? So unknown, like a rolling stone.
Keep working on that one, Bob. So that's the Like a Rolling Stone waltz. And believe me, when he started out, and there's records of it, it was even more embryonic. All of that lost. Well, we're at Newport now. And I have no beefs with the Newport thing, except, well, when Bob turns to the musicians and says, play loud, which was taken from the Manchester performance in May of 66, Bob actually said, play F-word loud. It's emblematic why they didn't have Chalamet do it the way it was. I don't mind the person yelling Judas. It was all fine. Pete eyeing the axes. I didn't have much beefs with that. So actually, you'd think I'd be griping about Newport. No, Johnny Cash was not there. And I think Johnny Cash was misused in this film. But whatevs. But let's go to the real thing. We heard Peter Yarrow introduce Bob, this amazing fawning introduction. The electricity is crackling. He comes on stage with a grossly under-rehearsed band. Mike Bloomfield is there. He's in his leather jacket. And, well, the S-word is about to go down. But this is the real thing. And I want you to zero in on just how great Mike Bloomfield is. And for a ragtag performance, no wonder half the audience sat in stunned disbelief and applause, and the other half was reaching for their metaphorical axes.
Farm no more.
Boo, get me that axe. I'm cutting that sound cable. Mike Bloomfield, ladies and gentlemen, and this is recorded, played right in the middle of the Highway 61 session, so let's just say they were all feeling their oats, but it's astonishing how good that was. You know, you think an apocryphal performance like that wouldn't be that good, but in fact it was. So we're at the end of this illumination into the alternate complete unknown, and they end the movie. I'm not going to have any complaints. Bob goes back to meet Woody again. Fine, whatever. And then they play the credit roll, and they play, I forget the Dylan track they play, but they didn't play the right one. I know this will surprise you that I feel that way. In my alternate movie, because you've seen Dylan at the Thomas Paine Award getting booed, and you know how traumatic it was, I would add this song at the end of the film, which ironically Bob wrote on the John Wesley Harding album. And this is a song that Bob has only done once his entire career. He did it in 1974 in Toronto, and of course on the 27 CD box set of every show of that tour. Guess what show is not on it, and the version is not on it. I digress. Frustrating. Bob is there to drive me crazy and all Dylan fans crazy. But anyway, he does this song only once. And before I play it, I just want to say the question I've been taunting you with is, why did Bob endorse the movie? Well, the fact is, Bob must love this movie because it basically bears little resemblance to any form of reality, which is the essence of who Bob Dylan is. Bob Dylan has been playing Bob Dylan since he hitchhiked to New York in 1961. Do you really think Bob would want an accurate, emotionally true, ecstatic truth film that really captures him? Of course not. That's why we love him. I wouldn't want that. The Bob Dylan movie that I've been making in my head for way too long is fine, and I am content with it. But I hope you've enjoyed this 2 hours alternate history. That's the way it goes. This is Eric Nelson. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. So imagine you're in the movie theater. You've heard all about the Thomas Paine Award. This song comes in, and if you're a Dylan fan, you're like, oh, that's what the song is about.
As I went out one morning to breathe the air around Tom Paine, I spied the fairest damsel that ever did walk in chains. I offered her my hand. She took me by the arm. I knew that very instant she meant to do me harm. Depart from but you have no choice. I beg you, sir, she pleaded from the corners of her mouth. I will secretly accept you, and together we'll fly south. Came running from across the field, shouting at this lovely girl and commanding her to yield. And as she was letting go her grip, up Tom Paine did run. I'm sorry, sir, he said to me, I'm sorry for what she's done.